Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Kotayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my co-guests. And my guest today is Frank Cisneros, who is a super talented bartender based in New York City. And Frank spent over a year in Japan recently and deeply immersed himself in Japanese cocktail culture, and mainly at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel, Tokyo, and many other cocktail bars in Japan, I'd assume. So Japanese cocktail culture is pretty unique and quite different from American cocktail culture. And Frank will tell us all about the difference today. So quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network, our website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and now on Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. And you can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. And now let's start our conversation with Frank Cisneros. Hi, Frank. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Hi, Akiko. Thank you for having me on.
So I'm very excited to have you because I had Kenta Goto before and also Shingo Gokan, who are really two pillars of cocktails in New York City as Japanese people. But you are the only person who's spoken about, you know, all those objective view to Japanese cocktail culture. So I'm so excited.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to talk to you.
Yeah. So first of all, where are you from and how did you get into the world of cocktails?
I'm originally from Madrid, Spain.
Wow.
Most people don't know that because I don't have an accent, but I moved to the United States when I was like six. So
So you're Spanish?
I'm Spanish.
Oh.
I'm a Spanish citizen, yeah. I got into cocktails kind of as an amateur in the early 2000s. It was right before I was 21, actually, so technically it was illegal.
Don't tell anybody.
Yeah, don't tell anyone. I used to go thrift shopping a lot. I lived in southwestern Washington State at the time, and I found a copy of William Boothby's World Drinks. I had no idea what it was. It was about a 100-year-old book at that time.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you about that because it's like I looked up. It's published in 1934, and it's like crazy rare book now.
It's crazy rare. I wish I still had that copy, but I don't. I bought it completely on a whim, and for my 21st birthday, my girlfriend at the time surprised me by building me a bar in my basement of the house that I lived in.
Ah, so because she likes drinking cocktails.
She likes drinking cocktails. So I spent, you know, about a year just like making all these weird little drinks from the book, like, you know, things like even like cocktails were famous in more famous in Japan than the United States, like a White Lady, for instance. I remember the first time I was actually legally 21 and I went to a bar in Portland, Oregon, which was the closest city to where I lived. And I asked for someone to make me a Tom Collins. Mm. And I was very confused that it was just like gin and like sour mix out of a gun.
Yeah.
I asked the bartender, like, you don't use fresh lemon juice and like cane sugar? And this is like 2000, like in Portland, Oregon, 2001, something like that. And they're like, I don't understand what you're talking about.
Wow.
Like, nobody does. I don't even know what that is. Flash forward many years later, I moved to New York
City. It's like a Back to the Future.
Right? Yeah. It's back to the future. Right. So many years later, I moved to New York City. And I started working in wine first as a sommelier.
Mm. Oh, why did you come to New York, by the way?
In 2006.
Okay, and then what brought you to New York?
I was actually a DJ at the time.
Wow, so many secrets today revealed.
So that was my goal, was to pursue that career, but I started working in restaurants, and I got very interested in wine because wine is very similar to music in many ways. It's esoteric. It's hard to find out that much information about it. Like, each rare wine is like a rare record. Mm. Finding the right record for the right time is like finding the right wine for the right food. So I got very interested in that, and I got my sommelier degree in 2007. Mm. But at that very same time, 2007 was this like fantastic year for cocktails in New York City. You had like Death & Company and PDT opened in late 2006, early 2007, and I worked on First Avenue between 6th and 7th Street, which is like right where Death & Co. and PDT were. So I would go there after work, after my like sommelier job, and I'd be like, wow, these guys are having a lot more fun than I am. More importantly, this reminds me of that William Boothby book that I used to have like 6 or 7 years ago.
Right. Well, that was really that was this big surge of cocktail culture.
Absolutely.
Admiration.
Yeah.
So for some reason, do you know why?
I don't. I think of it as like there's this famous music documentary called The Year That Punk Broke about 1991 about Nirvana and Mudhoney and all these different bands in the Pacific Northwest. I think 2007 is the year cocktails broke. It just broke into the scene. Mm. And so many things opened simultaneously.
Right. And also maybe the internet, like, you know, they grew up and, you know, the Audrey Sanders, those people started to be more visible, and their students became more capable and opening
absolutely
different places.
You know, and like Kenta is one of Audrey's, like, you know, and I think David Wandridge did a lot for us at that time too, because I think his first book came out right around that time.
Right.
It was just a perfect storm.
Mm. Right. So you were in the right time, in the right place.
Right time, right place. I just got very lucky.
Right. Well, maybe that's the reason your destiny created, your girlfriend, ex-girlfriend, whatever.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So that's the destiny I would call. Right. So so where did you work before your trip to Japan?
So I started my career in New York City as a sommelier at Counter, which was an all-organic and biodynamic wine bar at the time. And we were also doing a pretty cool organic cocktail program, which was, you know, pretty rare in 2007. I worked with Tanya Guffey at that time and Nick Jarrett. Nick Jarrett now is at Cure in New Orleans, and Tanya Guffey has had an incredible career. She ran Dram for many years, and she's now a brand ambassador for Highland Park. So that was sort of like my start. Then I really wanted to learn how to do cocktails properly. So by happenstance, I worked at a dive bar called Bushwick Country Club. But I worked with a gentleman named Tom Chadwick, and him and I used to do a cocktail hour at this dive bar, like starting back in around 2007. Mm. So we do cocktails there. And he later went on to open Dram. In 2008, I opened up Prime Meats with Damon Boltein. So Damon, you know, Damon is a very prominent figure here at Heritage Radio Network.
Right, yes. He's one of the hosts of
Speakeasy.
Speakeasy.
Yeah.
Right.
So I worked with him. And
you know what's one secret? I've known Damon for like over 10 years ago. You met, and he was a little young bartender at the Kyoto Fu in the meat park and the health kitchen.
Yeah.
And I was like, I couldn't recognize him since I met him 2 years ago again. I was like, what?
Oh, he's a big guy. Big beard, super tall, long hair.
Right. And a big cocktail figure too, so.
Yeah, I mean, I owe a tremendous amount of my career to both Damon Bolte and Tom Chadwick. I wouldn't be where I am now if it weren't for them. In 2011, I started working with Ravi Derossi, and we opened up Bourgeois Pig Brooklyn. I redid the program at Bourgeois Pig East Village, did Gin Palace, which was a really big thing in terms of like the whole cocktails on tap thing. Mm. Mayor Sabaro like taught me a lot about that kind of stuff as well. So yeah, that's what I was doing prior to moving to Japan.
Mm. Okay, and you know, just the just to bridge your classic cocktail book time to the modern New York time, how did it evolve in terms of your style of cocktails? Did you try to stay classic?
Mm, very and, classic, yeah.
And no soda guns.
Yeah, no beverage guns or anything like that. But no, I definitely stayed very classic. And I think that's not only like that initial entrance from randomly finding that book, but it's also the tutelage of people like Tom Chadwick and Damon Bolte, who are and other like good friends of mine, like Thomas Waugh, Brad Farron. I think all of us are very firmly rooted in the classics. I had the great pleasure of working with Cabell Tomlinson. Brian Miller would offer me a little bit of advice, and these are guys who are like, and I kind of agree with this, every great cocktail has really already been made. Like, that's also part of what speaks to me so much about Japanese bartending. It's so rooted in classics, and it's not so much about the drink. It's about everything else. It's about the holistic sort of experience that you can offer a guest. It's very unique and very hospitality-focused.
Right. Let's talk about it. So, first of all, when and where did you work in Japan?
So, in 2014, my really good friend Marshall Altier, another great guy. He's been around for a while. I think he was the very first head bartender of Death & Company back in 2006 or 7. Mm. He's been working with the Mandarin Oriental group in Asia Pacific as a sort of like overarching consultant. Mandarin Oriental Tokyo, being like a very culinary sort of adventurous place, you know, they hosted NoMa. Their famous pop-up there. Mm. They've got some incredible restaurants in the facility. It's only 178 rooms or something like that, but they have like 10 restaurants or something within that space. So they wanted to reach out to a couple of Western bartenders. Their ideal program was to have a Los Angeles bartender and a New York bartender come over to Tokyo and sort of share ideas. Like, this is how we do things in the West. Let's learn things about how we do things in Japan. Let's collaborate and sort of create new things.
Mm, great idea.
Yeah. I wish it wasn't my idea. I'm not that cool. that was in early 2014, but the visa process wound up being very, very, very difficult. Mm. So it took until the end. We started that process in maybe February of 2014. A couple of lawyers later and all this paperwork later, I finally got the visa in December. Unfortunately, my Los Angeles counterpart couldn't get the visa. It was just so difficult to get.
Wow.
Yeah. So, end of 2014, I went over to Tokyo. I'd never been to Japan in my entire life.
Hmm.
I flew into Haneda Airport, and they handed me a Zairyu card, and they're like, "Welcome to Japan. You live here now."
Wow. So, but you know, like, you were picked, chosen.
Sure.
What's the context of that?
Oh gosh. So. It's tough because, as you know, getting a visa to work in Japan is very, very difficult. Mm. Since I have a sommelier degree, they initially tried to have me come over on that. But since I was not going to be working as a sommelier, I was going to be working as a bartender, they had to sort of switch up the visa process. My visa is actually specialist in humanities.
Oh, wow. Which is... sounds like Gandhi or something.
yeah, right? Like, yeah, I'm not saving the world here. I'm just making cocktails. It's not that big of a deal.
That could be saving a life, too.
So you, I remember my application, like, weighed several pounds because it was expensive to send it to Japan.
Mm.
You had to prove, like, beyond a shadow of a doubt that you are contributing to the culinary scene of Japan.
Mm.
And so a lot of that was sort of innovating new techniques and showing that you had a lot of not just bartending experience, but sort of, like, management and educational type experiences.
Right. So somebody thought you have that capability, so you were invited.
Yes.
By the hotel.
Yes, it was. It was actually Mr. Thomas Combescott, who he was a food and beverage director here in New York prior to living in Tokyo as well. It was sort of he's the food and beverage director for the Mandarin Oriental Tokyo, and he's just an incredible guy. And I'm lucky that he believed in me.
Mm. So did you serve cocktails here in New York, and he was so impressed. He's yeah. The guy.
Yeah, yeah. He did come to my bar a long time ago. This is probably in 2008. He visited me a couple of times, and I guess I just popped into his mind almost 6 or 7 years later.
Wow, you must want something really right.
I hope so.
Right. So, okay, and then what was your responsibility at Mandarin Oriental?
So it was interesting. My title was specialist bartender. So my responsibility, my mission, was to show Japanese bartenders a little bit about Western-style technique. And what that means is not so much our motions or our technical sorts of things that we do behind the bar, but the West, we're almost to a fault too creative. Like, we're always trying to push the envelope. But, like, we make our own syrups. We try to develop new techniques like cocktails on tap, like all these different things that Western bartenders do. In Japan, like, my colleagues were a little bit scared, a little bit trepidatious of, like, making their own syrups because consistency is so important. So instead of, like, making your own raspberry syrup, they would buy raspberry syrup.
Mm.
Even simple syrup, which is just sugar and water, they would buy a Carib brand simple syrup.
Wow.
Just to make sure that it's perfect and simple and, like, just exactly the same every single time, which is something I greatly respect. But
by the way, that's a very Japanese mindset because,
yeah,
like, you know, everything's divided. There's no Japanese restaurant. There's a sushi restaurant, tempura restaurant, and each sushi restaurant has a specified vinegar provider.
Right.
The majority of them is customized. And those things, you know... professionals should make something specialized. That's like a Japanese phrase too.
Yeah.
So maybe
you focus very, very minutely on one thing, and you do that thing perfectly.
Mm.
So they wanted me to sort of break them from that mold a little bit and be like, you know what? We can make our own orgeat. Like, we can make our own almond syrup. We can, and it was thrilling. Believe me, like, it was really fun. The first, like, few times showing, like, my fellow colleagues, like, you know, instead of buying raspberry syrup, we can take real raspberries and we can make it into a syrup. And they're like, you can do that with real fruit? Like, we love fruit. So it was fun. But at times, it was difficult because, as you know, the hierarchical structure of the work environment in Japan is very, very strict. So my senpai, like, which is like your, you know, like your mentor, your higher up, she did not enjoy my American techniques as much. So, you know, the very first time I bartended there, I got an order for two different cocktails. And we had, mostly in Japan, you use a cobbler shaker, which is a three-piece shaker. To me, it's a much more beautiful way to create a drink. Just the style of shaking that you're forced to do with it is more elegant. It forces you to focus on only one drink at a time. It's beautiful, but I didn't have any experience with that because in America, we're used to two-piece shakers, which are very quick and efficient, but it's inelegant and a little dirty. So we had two sets of those, and I did the American thing, which is like I built two drinks at the same time. I picked up my tins, I clinked them together, I shook them both at the same time extremely loudly, poured them both at the same time, and You know, all the salarymen at the bar were dead silent, staring at me. All of my other colleagues were staring at me. My senpai walked over and goes, like, Frank-san, like, very interesting technique. Never, ever do that ever again.
Wow.
Just one at a time, please.
Wow. That's a very distinctive, kind of like opposite presentation. Right.
Yeah.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Right? Because I think it's more show in the American bartending scenes to shake.
Yes. So, I mean, I think that's an aspect of, it's an interesting aspect of a difference between American and Japanese bartending. Like, a lot of times American bartenders are like, look at me. Like, I'm here. Pay attention to me. Japanese bartenders, in a way, do that, but it's far more subtle. It's about, like, their technique is elegant and quiet and beautiful, and there's a efficacy of motion. Everything is very efficient. Everything is sort of like this beautiful showmanship, and, like, everything has to be perfect in your movements and your hands and your and how you're dressed and everything like that. But they're not drawing attention. They're sort of just commanding attention by virtue of the fact that everything they do is so beautiful. American bartending is sort of a offshoot of American culture. It's just like bombastic and big.
Right, yeah. So which is fascinating, but I think it's more like, you know, people joke about ninja, but the ninja is the most skilled people and then try to be in the background or even like invisible.
Right.
And people noticed after they did something.
Yeah.
That's the coolness in Japanese culture. So.
And you see that same sort of, like, you notice afterwards just how beautiful and amazing it was with, like, sushi and kaiseki counters as well.
Mm.
Like, the sushi chef and the kaiseki chef behind that counter, they're also doing the same sort of, like, subtle elegance.
Right. You take, probably you don't even take a notice because it's so perfect. And then you realize, wow. That's the difference.
Yeah.
Right. So, like, for instance, you know, like, let's talk about more, in you know, based on that, a little more details. Like, for instance, if you go to Japanese cocktail bar, which is independent of restaurants, there's no waiting bar in restaurants in Japan, right? Which is, I think it's sad. But if you go to serious cocktail bars, which is where you drink cocktails, it's more like hush-hush. And, quieter, darker.
Yes.
Maybe you can describe better than I do.
So there's several things that, like, are very distinctive about walking into a Japanese cocktail bar. When we say Japanese cocktail bar, a lot of times I think what we're saying is Ginza bars. And, like, Ginza, so Ginza's this neighborhood, of course, in Tokyo. It's in eastern part of Tokyo near Tokyo Station. It's very posh.
And expensive.
Very expensive. There's, you know, all the top department stores are there. Like, a typical day in Ginza is you go to, like, Mitsukoshi or something, like this very, like, high-end department store, and you'll go to a really expensive sushi restaurant, and then you'll end at a very expensive cocktail bar. And Ginza kind of functions as a focal point for the rest of Japanese cocktail bars. Like, cocktail bars from all over Japan sort of emulate different things that are going in Ginza. It's now, Ginza's kind of becoming old-fashioned. It's always been a little old-fashioned, I suppose. But, like, the true super classic Japanese style is Ginza. So one of the first things that you'll notice is you'll walk in and it's dead silent. And I mean, like, sometimes zero music playing. Like, there's, which is, I think, very odd to the Western sort of bar culture. Another big thing is you don't go to a bar to talk to the bartender necessarily. Not to have, like, lengthy conversations. Like, the conversations are polite but pretty quiet and pretty quick. It's about a moment of silence as a guest, a moment of silence, a break from the city where you go and you contemplate your cocktail quietly by yourself. Maybe with your guest.
Right.
And that's it.
Yeah, you never talk about
you're not talking to other guests.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, because I think that's kind of worshipping the techniques of the cocktails and the techniques, you know, the behind and all those discipline of the bartenders.
Yeah, it's really like it's very much a temple to a cocktail. And I've often described the act of going to a Japanese cocktail bar as a guest as being a participatory sport. So, like, you as the spectator, you're a part of the show too. Because the guest is, like when I would be making a drink in Japan, the guest is watching how many times I stir, how quietly I'm stirring, like how my motions are. If when you're placing all of the different tools that you're using on the bar, they all have to be equidistant. Everything, every aspect of what you're doing is beautiful, and they're watching all of it.
Mm.
In America, you go in, you order your drink, and then you immediately just turn to whoever you're hanging out with, and you ignore everything else that's going on.
That's true.
In Japan, the guest is very quietly observing everything.
Mm, interesting. And that reminds me of, you know, Japanese kisaden, the coffee shops.
Yeah.
It's the same respect to the product and the owner of the place, or of course, you know, the whoever's working to serve you. So I think it's like the service, omotenashi mindset.
Omotenashi, ne.
Mm.
Yeah.
How do you describe omotenashi?
Oh gosh, so omotenashi, I've written a guide now that I use as a training tool for bars that I work with to show fellow bartenders what Japanese cocktail making is all about.
Mm, wow.
And we tend in the West to be kind of obsessed with technique and like, do the Japanese bartenders use their jigger twice with two different syrups? I'm like, doesn't matter. Don't worry about that. The number one most important thing to think about in Japanese bartending is omotenashi.
Mm.
So omotenashi is hospitality. However, the Japanese concept of hospitality is just above and beyond everything. And I think it's two different things. First of all, you have from birth, like every Japanese person is taught about like the importance of omotenashi and just being a hospitable person.
Mm.
Like you hear stories about like how at like Japanese kindergartens and elementary schools, all of the students like clean their own.
Yeah, like after school, the whole classrooms.
You clean your own classroom, right?
Yeah.
So it's a sort of like massive emphasis on harmony in your society. So hospitality is an offshoot of that. So already every single person in Japan is kind of a lot more hospitable than we are in the West. And when you elevate that to being like a professional hospitalitarian, if you're like at an izakaya, which is just like, you know, your sort of typical everyday like gastropub, their level of service is like our Michelin level here.
Mm.
And so then when you have a Michelin level service in or a 5-star hotel service like the Mandarin Oriental, you're expected to go way, way above and beyond.
Mm.
So like two examples of that would be I went to Star Bar once in Ginza, and I was by myself and I was hungry. It was raining.
Mm. Is that a Hoshi?
Yeah.
Yeah. Famous.
He's been there for a long, long time. Yeah.
Right.
I was hungry. It was raining. And I said, I want to get some yakitori. It's kind of close to Shinbashi, but not that close. But there's yakitori, pretty good yakitori in Ginza as well.
Mm.
So he's like, oh, yeah, I'll take you there. So he got an umbrella, walked me out the door, like walked me downstairs, which is like upstairs, a couple flights of stairs, and then walked me like a couple of blocks down to the yakitori stand and bought me like my first stick of yakitori.
Wow.
Like that is omotenashi, you know, that's hospitality.
Right.
And then I learned from that, like as much as I possibly could. So an example of me doing that in Japan was I had a guest who he'd been staying at the hotel for for a few days, for a while, like about a week. And I knew it was his birthday. He was missing home and all this stuff. And he was going to go back home the next day. And he was really into these like rice snacks that we used to have. What's the term for bar snacks? Otsumami.
Otsumami.
Otsumami, yeah. So we had this otsumami. And he loved them. And so I had a 15-minute break. Like that's like a, you know, union sanctioned 15-minute break.
Yeah.
Ran downstairs, 37 flights of stairs. I took the elevator downstairs, 37 flights of stairs. Hopped on my mama chari, like my little bicycle. Like like grandma style bicycle.
Yeah.
Rode 5 minutes to the shop where I know that we bought them, and I got like a giant like pillow sack worth of it. And then brought it back home and I sent it up to his room.
Mm.
You know, so that he had like snacks to have on the plane. Like, because he loved that snack. Like, that's the sort of thing that's like in America, it's like, wow. But in Japan, it's like normal.
Mm.
That's like basic.
Right.
Basic omotenashi.
Mm. Wow. So you really take all those things in yourself, sounds like.
Try to. You know, like when I got back home, when I got back to the United States, my first job was working at Karasu.
Mm.
So Thomas Waugh started the program there. I helped a little bit. I helped as much as I could.
Mm.
But one thing that I tried to do all the time and that we all tried to do there is jump under the bar and walk the guest out. You know, hold the door open and just say bye individually to each guest.
Mm.
If you can.
Right.
It's a really nice touch.
Well, the bar in America is almost synonymous to like being busy,
yeah,
like loud and busy and exciting, energetic.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the opposite cultural element, right? And so this. I also heard that the bar setup is different.
Mm. It's very different. So in the United States, in New York specifically, our style. And I'm not sure if it was always this way, but our style is busy. The bar itself is very busy.
Mm.
We sort of pride ourselves on having several dozen syrup bottles and spirit bottles like on the bar counter itself. All of your tools are on the bar counter. You have bitters everywhere. It looks like an apothecary, like a pharmacy.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that style. You know, that's our style. But in Japan, it's the total opposite. Mm. Everything is just clean, clear, and simple. Nothing on the bar. Not even not a jigger, not a shaker, nothing. Nothing is on the bar. A great example of that is Gen Yamamoto in Akasaka.
Mm. Gen Yamamoto, that's the bar's name too.
Yeah, that's right. He's the gentleman. He used to work at Brushstroke, and then he started his own namesake bar. It's this beautiful 8-seat counter, and it's always 8 seats in Japan, or very often. So this beautiful 8-seat counter, and it's so minimal that even there's no bottles in the back bar either. There's just nothing.
Mm.
You can't see anything. And I think there's two reasons for that, or at least two reasons why it works really well for Japanese-style cocktail making. The first reason is anything that's in between you and the guest is going to prevent you from doing great omotenashi.
Mm.
You know, like if you're having to reach over bottles like very uncomfortably, like if you can't really see like where the guest is at and like in their drink, like you can't achieve the level of hospitality that you need to be achieving in Japanese cocktail making. The second thing is that because the art of making the cocktail is so participatory, that it like that the guest wants to be watching that, that you're being so subtle with everything that you do as a bartender. You're not drawing attention, but you're just commanding attention. Anything that blocks that sort of sight line, I think, is viewed poorly.
Right.
So that's been something that's been really important to me as a ambassador of Japanese technique coming back to the United States is trying to teach bars to clear their back bars and clear their front bars. Another actually important aspect of that too is that you're supposed to be so clean and so perfect in your drink making that you're not spilling a drop of anything on the bar counter itself. So you don't need mats and bar mats and drink rails and all these other tools that we use in America to make up for like our spills because of our focus on speed.
Right.
Like, you're just so perfect that everything's just clean.
Mm.
It proves that you're clean.
Right. Wow. Sounds like the minimalist, like, Zen temple approach. Less is more.
Yep.
your focus is there because this is less.
You know, when Thomas Waugh was starting Karasu, him and I sat down and we talked a lot about what differentiates Japanese cocktail technique and American cocktail technique. And I think that's something that kind of shocked him a little bit at first. He's like, well, we can't have all the tools and all that stuff there. But then after a couple of weeks of working together, I remember he said, like, this is actually very liberating.
Mm.
Like, it feels very liberating as an American bartender to be like, wow, there's not a bunch of stuff in front of me. I can just interact with my guest.
Interesting. Wow. So it's not the opposite. Probably it's kind of like a reminding, inspiring each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Mm. Okay. There's a lot more to talk about. So I have to just throw in some break here. So so when I can come back, we'll talk more about the details of cocktail culture's differences and also more interesting, fun plans of Frank. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Kiko Tema. My guest today is Frank Cisneros, who is a New York-based bartender and who spent over a year in Japan recently and deeply immersed himself in Japanese cocktail culture. So let's continue talking about the difference between American and Japanese cocktail culture. So one thing I heard is that the bar tools, they're different.
Mm. Yes.
So
it's really interesting now because you have bar tool suppliers like Cocktail Kingdom and even barsupplies.com, I think is one of them. So many Western bar tool suppliers have changed their lineup to be actually Japanese style bar tools, in particular Japanese bar spoons and Japanese jiggers have become like de rigueur. It's just like everyone kind of standardly uses them. However, everyone kind of uses them wrong.
Okay.
and myself included. So back when Cocktail Kingdom first started, for instance, that was at least when I first started buying from them in 2007-2008, Greg Baum was sort of like, he still is like an ambassador of Japanese bartending and had traveled there more than almost any of us. And he was bringing back all these incredibly beautiful tools. And this is, you know, 2007-2008, like our bar tools were pretty dismal in the United States at that time. They weren't pretty, they were functional, but they certainly weren't beautiful. And he was bringing back all these beautiful spoons and beautiful Hawthorne strainers, and everything was gold-plated and just crystal mixing glasses. It was just, like, soul-crushingly beautiful. So, you know, every few weeks, something new would come out. Greg would let us know, and it was, like, a race between, like, Damon Bolte, Thomas Waugh, Brad Farron, and myself, like, and all of us were at different bars. Sometimes we were all at the same bar. We'd all go there and try to buy these, like, beautiful Japanese bar spoons and all this barware that was coming out, and it was really expensive stuff too. But you know, one time in maybe I think in 2008, I had a Japanese gold teardrop spoon, a Yarai crystal mixing glass, and a Baron gold Hawthorne strainer. And Greg Baum was over at Prime Eats where I was bartending, and you know, I was stirring my drink the best that I possibly can. And I left the spoon in my mixing glass, and I put my Hawthorne strainer over the mixing glass. And this is at a time when no one used Hawthorne strainers with mixing glasses. Mm. They used julep strainers. And, you know, I poured out my drink, And Greg was like, hey, like, you're the first person I've ever seen that's done that the actual Japanese style. And I was like, I had no idea. Like, there's, I mean, YouTube barely existed. Like, there was no way for me to know how they actually did it in Japan. I'd never been there. But then actually going to Japan, I wound up learning a lot of things, like, in terms of how incorrectly we actually use the tools. So right now, trident spoons are very popular. So this is a long mixing spoon for stirring a cocktail like a Manhattan or a martini. And on the end, there's a trident. And for the most part, like, I think we think the trident is used to, like, grab a garnish, or it's just a decorative element, or it reflects the light beautifully, and it does do all those things really well. But the main reason why bartenders in Japan use that trident spoon is because when you're mixing a gin and tonic, which is a very popular drink in Japan, you flip the trident over, and the trident is used to skirt past the ice so that you can put the lime further down into the drink.
Wow.
So it has a specific purpose, but it's a purpose that none of us ever do here in the West. And again, talking about cobbler shakers, so these are your three-piece shakers that are like, you know, what you imagine James Bond shaking a martini with. It creates a very different drink. Your shaking style and the type of ice that you use with that type of shaker emulsifies the drink and aerates it in a way that what we do in the West, which is we often double strain, meaning that we shake, we have a Hawthorn strainer, and then we have a little tea strainer to strain further. That tea strainer no longer becomes necessary because the sort of frothiness of the drink and the shards of ice that float on top of it become a feature of the drink as opposed to something you don't want.
Right.
So it's very, very different. The tools, we often think of the tools as just being gorgeous, but they have a very specific function.
Right. So more details.
Yeah.
In the pursuit of perfection.
And the tools are important because the tools will inform your style. So it's very important that, I say this often, that Japanese cocktail bartending is a holistic thing. It's all-encompassing. There's many, many little details. If you're only doing two or three of those details, it's not going to make that much of a difference. But if you do all 50 of those details, then a guest will come in and say, okay, this is different.
Right.
This is very different.
And an obvious one is the ice, right? Especially hand-carved, and it doesn't melt too quickly.
Right.
And also the ice itself is more clear, like transparent.
Yeah, it's more pure. So it's very interesting because obviously in the past 10 years here in America, our ice has improved quite a bit, and we're lucky to have things like Okamoto, which was really the first, and then 100 Weight started their ice company.
He came here. Okamoto? The ice.
I just emailed him today. I talked to him a lot. His ice is fantastic. But to be fair, ice of that quality here in New York City and just in the West in general is expensive, very, very expensive. In Japan, they never really stopped producing really high quality ice like that. Obviously here, many years ago during like the cocktail sort of heyday, so like think of like the 1880s through the 19-teens up to Prohibition, everyone was using fantastic ice because it was essentially like harvested lake ice is what they were using. You know, so it's like perfect, beautiful, clear, wonderful ice. Then we sort of, you know, we went through the war period and then we went into the post-war sort of consumerist period in which every bar and every house had their own like ice machine or their own refrigerator. In Japan, they never went through Prohibition. So cocktails come to Japan in the 1880s. They're using the same sort of like big block ice, and they just kept on going. To this day, the continuity never ended. So even if you're like at a kind of divey bar and Golden Guy in Shinjuku, like you'll see the bartenders, they don't have their own ice machine in the bar. They never have their own ice machine. They just run to the konbini and get this ice that's perfectly clear. And whereas in the United States, we might be paying $30 or $40 for a slab of ice. In Japan, that same amount of ice costs like $1.50. It's really, really inexpensive. So there's no reason not to have excellent quality ice all the time.
Interesting. Wow. So the other thing that comes to my mind, shaking, which relates to ice.
Yeah.
Right? So Like things like, you know, what's called the heart shake.
Right, yeah.
Like maybe you can just talk about specific way to shake.
Yeah, so you know, the heart shake has become like a legend in the West. And I think it's a little bit of a misnomer because I think oftentimes us Western bartenders assume that shaking with a cobbler shaker is automatically the hard shake, and just shaking in any way that emulates the Japanese style is the hard shake. And it's really not. The hard shake was developed by one specific bar. I believe it was Star Bar.
No, that's Ueda-san of Tender.
Yeah, bartender.
Right,
yeah.
That's exactly. In Ginza.
Exactly, it's in Ginza also. They're all in Ginza.
Right, I know.
So yeah, it was developed by Ueda-san. And it's very specific because they have a very specific ice that they use.
Mm.
So
actually, Ueda-san, one time I went to bartender, I was like nervous, but I spoke to him.
Yeah.
And I asked him how he gets his ice. And yeah. He said he makes his own.
Yeah, he makes it. Yeah. So I make my own as well now too.
Mm, wow.
Yeah. So that's the thing. So he makes his own ice. So it's very specific and it has like a type of hardness and like the water that he uses, I think, is very soft water, right? So it's very specific to his thing. And then he also has his own specific shakers that he uses. I can't remember if they're Birdie or which brand he uses, but he developed his style. He developed that hard shake around his type of ice and his type of tools.
Wow.
So if you don't have that combination, if you're not Ueda-san and you're not at Star Bar, you can't do the hard shake.
Wow.
Because it's not going to improve your drink. It's really, it's form follows function.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. But, you know, basically what I read, you know, assuming I'm not Ueda-san, I don't have his bar or my ice, but there's a basic thing that can kind of follow the rules. I heard the hard shake. Make the odd shards kind of more evenly or something. It doesn't melt. The custard doesn't get diluted because of the shape of the ice.
No, absolutely. I try to teach bartenders that I work with like how to shake based on the type of ice that we currently have available to us and the type of tools that we have so that we can achieve the results that we need.
Mm.
Because we do want that. We do want that little like ice shard sort of thing, which is so funny because 10 years ago in New York, we hated that. We didn't want that at all. But now things are changing.
So it's a mouthfeel and it doesn't get melt too much too quickly.
Mouthfeel is so important to Japanese cocktails. Mm. Like a good example of that is that stirred cocktails like Manhattan, Martini, the spirit is often kept frozen in a freezer. So you keep your gin in a freezer at really cold, like minus 20 degrees Celsius. Mm. It's so cold it like burns your hand when you pick it up. And the reason for that is when you stir a drink that's that cold, you wind up having a very viscous, very thick martini. And the mouthfeel is very impressive. Like in Japanese food, texture is so, so important.
Mm.
Cocktails sort of follow that same method.
Interesting. So that slowness of melting the ice contributes more appreciation of the texture over time. It keeps changing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what happens too is that in the United States, we drink cocktails very, very, very fast. in Japan, first of all, like when you're going to one of these bars in Ginza or in Shinjuku or Roppongi, like there's a service fee. Like you get a little otoshi with your service fee. So otoshi is like a little snack, a little welcome snack. But there's generally a service fee attached to that. And with cocktail bars, it can be pretty expensive, maybe $30 for one bar.
Right.
And then each cocktail is also pretty expensive.
Mm.
So you're not drinking super fast and you're definitely not there to become inebriated. The goal is not to drink to get drunk. The goal is to sit there with your cocktail quietly and enjoy it slowly. So the melt point is crucially important. A big thing that we do, like at we did it at Bar Uchu and we do it now at Bar Moga, is carve ice into diamonds, into a multifaceted diamond shape. And there's really two reasons for that. Like first is you're enhancing the beauty of whatever you're putting in it, particularly whiskey, because it's reflecting of all the facets of the diamond. But the shape of the diamond itself helps the drink to be chilled at the bottom, but not overly diluted. And so you can drink it for a while. I think Ueno-san at
the tender
at Bar High Five.
Oh, that's the, Ueno-san.
Yeah.
In Ginza.
He talks about this too, about how when you carve ice into a diamond, it'll, as it melts, it becomes a mushroom shape. Because the bottom is not is diluting at a different rate than the top.
Right.
So again, it's an example of something being beautiful in Japan, but it has a real important function as well.
Mm. Amazing. Wow, I didn't know all the details. So, okay. Well, I can keep continuing those details, but I'll save for the next time. But now, so you came back to New York and you were at Bamuga, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I met you at the Uchu. I was so impressed about your styles and the service omotenashi. And I recruited you to the show, actually.
Thank you.
So since you came back to New York, say, how did your style change?
So definitely coming back to New York, Karasu was my first job back here in New York. And the first day I stepped behind that bar, I felt like, oh my God, I'm back in Japan. I just felt like that because the bar was laid out like that. And, you know, it was clear and clean and simple. And we were attempting to do things in the Japanese style, but I learned that there were several things that I could not do.
Mm.
Like I reverted back to my very quiet Japanese bartender way, like where I don't talk to the guests too much and everything is like kegel, like shitsuri shimashita.
Yeah, it's additionally respectful way to speak in Japanese.
Omatase shimashita.
Right.
Like, I'm sorry that I created a wait for you. Like, and so I was being like, in Japan that works, but in the West, like we want the bartender to be a little bit more warm and fun and a party guy.
I was so, like, are you okay?
Yeah. So I had to learn to stop doing that.
Mm.
And then there's just like little things like, when you're at a Japanese cocktail bar, they don't give you water with your cocktail. Typically, you have to ask for water.
Right.
Or like a chaser.
Mm.
Right. A chaser is always water.
Right.
In Japan.
Right.
So yeah, just things like that. Like I would kind of instruct people like, no, we have to do things exactly like they did it in Japan, exactly like I was taught in Japan. But I've learned now that there's some things that translate very well and some things that don't.
Right. Interesting. So that politeness doesn't work, and then
that level is just a little bit too much.
Right. So what works, in other words?
So what works is definitely in terms of technique, being very mindful of your motions works. I try the two words that I tell all of the bartenders I work with right now are quietude and elegance.
Mm.
So watch how you're moving, watch your posture, and how you carry yourself. Those things are going to translate. And then omotenashi, walking people to the door. Don't simply point at the bathroom. Like, take the extra 2 seconds. It really, really, really makes a huge difference. And the most important thing is just a sense of composure, where instead of focusing only on what's inside the glass, you focus on everything else. So the glassware itself is so important.
Mm.
Like, the glassware must be beautiful and delicate. Your coaster has to be beautiful and elegant. For so long, and myself included, Western bartenders defined themselves strictly by what was in the glass. Like, look at how good I am at combining these 4 or 5 ingredients. Japanese approach is sort of like, look, we can all combine 4 or 5 ingredients into doing something great. Everything else is what's really important.
Right. So it's a little culture package of all those omotenashi and care and respect. So, okay. And so the Karasu was in Fort Greene, Brooklyn.
Correct.
And then you went to Uchu in Lower East Side.
Right.
And now you're at the Bamuga, which is in West Village.
Correct.
So what kind of cocktail do you offer at the Bamuga?
So at Bamuga right now, it's really cool. I'm sort of continuing the the theme of like moga is like modern gal.
Mm.
It's you know, in Japanese, there's a lot of portmanteau, like combining two words together, right?
Yeah, we like that.
Yeah, it's a fun wordplay.
Right.
So it's sort of the Japanese equivalent of flappers. So 1920s Japan, like really like cool modern women. I tried to name all the drinks after people who, like Japanese women who are very inspiring.
Mm.
And the cocktails themselves often have shochu.
Mm.
So almost all of our cocktails have shochu. They'll have another spirit too. So it's what we call split basing. So you have rum and shochu, gin and shochu, whiskey and shochu.
Yeah.
And it's a sort of a twofold thing. Like, first of all, I adore shochu. I think it's the coolest spirit out there right now. If you think about it, there's no other spirit that has more sense of terroir and more ways of expressing themselves than shochu. Because shochu can be made of one of like 30-some ingredients. It can only be distilled once. So if it's made, the mugi shochu, which is barley, or imo shochu, which is sweet potato, you can taste the barley. You can taste the sweet potato. And like barley shochu from Fukuoka tastes much, much different from an imo shochu from Kagoshima. Like its sense of place is very, very there.
Right.
You know, or kokuto shochu or awamori from Okinawa, like they're just so different. You know, maybe rum is the only thing that's even close to being as expressive as shochu is. And shochu can be aged, unaged, so many different things. So whenever possible, I try to do that. Like, I have a drink right now called Barley Two Ways, which uses Kintaro, which is a Baizen Mugi shochu. So it's a roasted barley shochu from Yame, so just south of Fukuoka in Kyushu, so southern island of Japan. And has this really beautiful sort of like, it always reminds me of breakfast cereal.
Okay.
And so that's combined with a scotch. So you've got barley from scotch and barley from Japan combined together. A little bit of a house sweet vermouth that we do, and Benedictine, and some bitters. It's sort of like a Bobby Burns variation.
Wow. What's the name of the cocktail? I have to order that.
It's called Barley Two Ways.
Okay.
Because it's literally two different ways of doing barley.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So where can we find your update, like all those things?
I am terrible at social media, but I do have an Instagram account. It's at Otsukarebiru.
Otsukarebiru.
So Otsukare-sama is like, thank you for your hard work. And it was a tradition with my coworkers at the Mandarin that the first beer that we drank after work was the Otsukarebiru.
Okay, so that spells like K-A-R-A-R-E.
B-I-I-R-U.
Right. Okay, so it's not beer, like biru. B-I-R-U, right?
B-I-I-R-U.
Okay, I have to follow you. And also, you said you're writing a book, right?
It's a dream, yeah. I'm talking to a couple of friends of mine who have published books, and the goal is to sort of encapsulate the year that I spent in Japan. So anecdotal fun things and stupid mistakes that I made here and there, and make it kind of funny, interspersed with the actual definition of what Japanese bar technique is all about. Technical information and information about sake, wine, and Japanese whiskeys.
You have to make it happen. I really can't wait to read it. Seriously.
Thank you.
Yeah, so we'll come back when the book is published.
Thank you.
And before that, of course. There's so many things I couldn't finish today, so.
We didn't even talk about Japanese whiskey. That's a whole hour's worth of conversation.
Right? Well, seriously, that's really the topic.
Yeah.
You know, the Fukuyo-san from Suntory, he's a master chief blender, came and talked about it. But Japanese whiskey is now really huge collective items, and
it's the hottest category out there right now. And you know, Derek Feldman, the owner of Bar Uchu, was just very dedicated to letting me achieve the dream of collecting Japanese whiskeys. And I think we got up to about 76. They just picked up a few more too. They got the Joker from the Hanyu, from the famous, one of the rarest whiskeys in the world.
Right.
And at Bar Moga, we're up to 50 now. So that's also between those two, those are two of the largest commercial collections.
I didn't know there's only close to 80 Japanese whiskeys. I didn't know that.
Oh, there's a lot out there. Yeah.
Okay, so that's the next topic. We'll
next
come back.
Right.
Okay, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
See you soon. Listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneseats@heritageradionetwork.org or kikotema.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org and iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please subscribe to Japan Needs. And our engineer today is David Tadasuyore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.